John 19. It's 4th and 25. Ole Miss leads in overtime by a touchdown. And if the Hawks can't match it, it's game over. Brandon Allen takes a snap and drops back. Throws about a 15-yard pass to Hunter Henry, who is immediately hit by a defender. If you pause the game at that moment, you would see Hunter Henry being taken to the ground, and you would see Ole Miss defenders swarming him, and you would think that's it. Game over. John 19, starting in verse 28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things had already been accomplished, to fulfill the scripture, said, "I'm thirsty." A jar full of sour wine was standing there, so they put a sponge full in a branch upon a branch of hyssop and brought it to his mouth. Therefore, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And he bowed his head and gave up the spirit. It's easy to become so acquainted and so familiar with the crucifixion scene of Jesus that we find ourselves reading it somewhat removed. But for just a moment, I want to help you hear this cry that Jesus made from the perspective of the Apostle John. Take yourself back to this, this point in time in Jesus' life. You're John, and you're with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and you have spent the night fighting sleep. And Jesus has spent the night praying, and he's admonished you three times for your inability to stay awake. Finally, he says, "Get up, it's time to go." When he says that, you look off into the garden and you see torchlights coming your way, approaching closer and closer. And as they draw close enough, you are able to hear the voice of angry mob to make out the threats and promises of violence. You see Judas leading the pack, and he comes up and he kisses Jesus. And after doing so, two men with swords ascend upon him. And as you might expect, Peter grabs his sword and starts swinging it at the people that are trying to take Jesus. And chops off someone's ear. And you're ready to grab your sword too until Jesus says, "Stop, Peter. Put your sword away." Then he takes and attaches the man's severed ear back on. This frightening realization begins to settle in on you that Jesus is not going to resist. Jesus is not going to pull out some last-minute miracle as he has done before. He's going to submit himself to the desires of this angry mob. And as you realize that, you see in your vision, peripheral vision, other apostles breaking as this conclusion comes to their mind, breaking from the crowd and running away. And despite the promise that you made to never leave Jesus, to die with Jesus just hours before, you are overcome by fear, and like everyone else, you break and you run for your life. Later that night, you get word that Jesus is taken to the house of Annas, that is, father-in-law to the high priest, to be tried. Because you know the high priest, you make your way there to see what's going to happen. And as you stand there in the outskirts in the shadows, you see Jesus as this mock trial takes place, as he is charged with blasphemy and charged with being a traitor, and is sentenced by the Jewish rulers to death. And you see as some of the soldiers that are around there blindfold him, strike him, mock him, and make fun of him. You follow the crowd that takes him to the praetorium, the house, the home of the Roman governor, Pilate. And standing there in that crowd, you see as those up front demand for Pilate to come out and deal with this traitor, to deal with this man. And he eventually comes out, and he takes Jesus inside. You stand there and you wait. You listen to the angry mutterings of the mob. And you breathe a sigh of relief when Pilate comes back out, stands and addresses the mob and says, "I find no guilt in this man." But then your heart sinks within you when you hear him ask, "Do you want me to release Jesus or Barabbas to you?" And with one voice, the crowd cries out, "Give us Barabbas." Pilate goes back inside. More time passes. It seems like hours. You're praying. You're praying for a miracle to happen. Finally, he brings Jesus back out. And as you look at him, he is standing there in this purple robe. He's got a crown of thorns shoved onto his head, and blood is trickling down from where those thorns have penetrated his skin. And you look down, and his legs has blood running down them, and blood is dripping onto the dusty ground where he stands. You see Pilate get up before the crowd and take a bowl of water and wash his hands and said, "On your own head be it." So you follow behind the excited crowd as they surround Jesus and then strap this crossbeam of a cross onto his back, and you watch as they begin to push him outside to the hill of Golgotha. And you watch as Jesus, overcome by the beatings, by overcome by all that he has endured, you see him with that cross beam on his back falling down, and the scabs are reignited, the wounds from his scourging are reignited. You see the air expelled from his lungs. You see him try to push himself up once, twice, and three times, but he just doesn't have the strength to do it any longer. You see a Roman soldier push this unwilling stranger forward and take the cross off Jesus and put it on this man, and then drag Jesus to his feet and carry him stumbling out to Golgotha, the place of the skull. You watch as they then take and hammer nails into his hands, into his feet, affixing him to the cross. And as they lift him up, you see it fall, and you hear him cry out, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." You stand there for 6 hours. In bewildered astonishment, Jesus is hanging there in bitter agony. Finally, you hear Jesus say to somebody, "I'm thirsty." And someone brings and affixes a drink attached to a sponge to Jesus' lips, and he takes a drink and he swallows a mouthful, and then he cries out, "Tetelestai." And you crumple to the ground. It's finished. That is, to John, the cry of failure. That is, to John, the cry of rejection. That is the cry of unfulfilled promise. That is the cry of your dreams shattering. That's the cry of 3 years wasted. That's the cry of your world crashing down. If you were to pause right there in that moment from John's perspective, you would think, that's the game. You and I, we hear those words, and that's a cry of victory, we understand. That's a cry of triumph. But in that moment, all John can hear is defeat. Go with me to Luke 24. 3 days have come and gone. Luke 24. There's two disciples who are traveling to Emmaus, and Jesus appears unbeknownst to them and walks with them. Luke 24, starting in verse 17. He, that is Jesus, said to them, "What are these words that you are exchanging with one another as you're walking?" And they stood still, looking sad. One of them, named Clopas, answered and said, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened here in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "The things about Jesus the Nazarene, who was a prophet, mighty indeed in word in the sight of God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to the sentence of death, and they crucified him. But we were hoping that it was indeed he who would redeem Israel." You hear the disappointment of these two disciples? "We indeed were hoping that it was he who would redeem Israel." You're John, and you heard those words Jesus spoke from the cross. And you go and you report to the other apostles what you heard. You saw him die. You saw him breathe his last. And you saw him cry out, "It's over. It's finished." The apostles are terrified. They're hunkered down in a house, thinking that the Jews are going to come and crucify them. Jesus appears to them, alive and in the flesh, and says, "Peace be to you." And all of a sudden, those three words that you heard, which were words of defeat in your mind, become now words of triumph. A victorious, exultant shout of finality. Were you to compile all of the significant things that the Bible has to say as you would consider the weight that they carried and the implications that they carried, I don't know that you would find three words, one in the Greek, but three words that are more powerful than this statement that Jesus utters from the cross when he says, "It is finished." To be able to appreciate the full significance of this, we must ask the question, what is the "it" that Jesus is referring to? When he says, "It is finished," what is the "it" that Jesus is referring to? Let me show you four things that came to an end when Jesus made this statement. First, his suffering had come to an end. How long had Jesus been suffering? He'd been on the cross for 6 hours. We're told that from the third hour to the ninth hour, Jesus was on the cross. When you compile the gospel accounts, that's how long he was there. So you might say Jesus' suffering was 6 hours. And indeed, there was a uniqueness to his suffering on the cross. But I think you can trace it back even further. If you go back 12 to 18 hours prior to this, Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And we know the depth of his sorrow there. from the various Gospels account that tell us as he's there praying, he is in agony, he is begging his Father, let this cup pass from me. Luke gives us the detail that his sweat became as great drops of blood. So he was suffering for 12 to 18 hours. Well, you can make a case that maybe he was suffering for the last 3 to 3.5 years. From the moment his earthly ministry began, Jesus knew that he was destined for the cross. If you were able to know the exact moment, and in Jesus' case, the excruciating, painful way in which your end was going to come, do you think you could ever have a happy moment again with that hanging over your head? I don't care if you knew that your end was 80 years out. If you knew that a dreadful, painful, torturous death awaited you, it would be hard to find happiness in life again. And Jesus knew how his life was going to end as his ministry began. He says to Nicodemus, you know, Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. He knows the fate that awaits him. And we could go on. In Luke 12:50, he says, I have a baptism to undergo, and how distressed I am until it is accomplished. That baptism is his suffering that he's going to face on the cross. It's not here yet, but as it looms overhead, Jesus says, it causes me great distress. As he anticipates the pain, as he anticipates the betrayal, as he anticipates the humiliation, he's been living under the burden of the cross for a while. But let me suggest that his suffering could have indeed been much longer than that. I believe it began the very moment he came to this earth. Suppose that one day, having lived in heaven for 10 million years, so long that you've forgotten what it was like to live on this earth, imagine knowing the fellowship of God, the joy of heaven, the splendor of heaven, the peace, the tranquility, the joy, the perfect love, then being imagined sucked back down here to earth, full of sorrow, full of pain, full of tears, full of sin, and full of death. If theoretically we could comprehend what it was like knowing the joy of heaven and then being brought back to earth, how terrible might our suffering be. Yet Jesus, when he cries out, it is finished, and as he yields his spirit to God, that suffering that he knew on earth for those 33 years or so, it's coming to an end. Secondly, we see when Jesus issued this victorious cry, he was signaling that his work on earth was finished. In the ancient world, when a servant was sent on a mission by his master and successfully returned having completed it, he would say to his master, tetelestai, that is, the mission that you have sent me on is accomplished. It's been done. It was successful. We made the observation a couple of weeks ago that Jesus did not go to the cross voluntarily. He came willingly, he went willingly, but Jesus went to the cross because it was the Father's will that sent him there. There's two passages I want to look at, the first of which is in Luke 2. One statement that's made at the beginning of Jesus' life, or early in Jesus' life, and the other which is made near the end. Two passages that help us understand that Jesus came with the knowledge of a purpose. See, Matthew and Luke record a few scant details about Jesus' birth. They pick up mainly in the gospel story. The only thing we know about Jesus in between the ages of about 2 and 30 is the single event right here that occurs in Luke chapter 2. Now we know how the story goes as Jesus is taken to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, that his mom and dad, after celebrating it, I say mom and dad, is Mary and Joseph, leave after having celebrated it and believing Jesus to be with another company. They continue on. They get looking for Jesus about a day later, find out he's not there. So they rush back to Jerusalem and they spend 3 days looking for Jesus. They find him in the temple. Read verse 49 of Luke 2. And Jesus said to them, why is it that you were looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my Father's house? Alternative and preferable translations for me, did you not know that I had to be about my Father's business? Now, what Jesus knows about God's plan for him at 12 years old, we don't know if it was a little, if it was a lot. We're not sure. What we do know is that he has some sort of vague or perhaps a more detailed understanding of the work that God had sent him on. He realized, I've got to be about my Father's business. And so Jesus lives, at least from this moment onward, with the expectation of fulfilling and accomplishing the work that God had gave him to do. Last statement is made by Jesus regarding this is in John 17. Now, I doubt this is the last prayer that Jesus offered before he died, But it is probably the last peaceable, undisturbed conversation that he is able to have with his father before he returns and sees him again face to face. As he prays in John 17, look at verse 4. Jesus said, "I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work which you have given me to do." Right now, in the garden before the cross, is his work truly done? Albert Barnes makes an insightful remark. When Jesus says, "I have finished," in verse 17, 4 of John, he probably means to include his death also. All the preparations for that death were made. He had preached to the Jews. He had given them full proof that he was the Messiah. He had collected his disciples. He had taught them the nature of his religion. He had given them his parting counsel. There was nothing remaining to be done but to return to God. We see here that Jesus was careful that his great and important work should be done before his dying hour. He did not postpone it to be performed just as he was leaving the world. So completely he had done the work that even before his death he could say, "I have finished the work." And then he goes on to remark, how happy would man be if we imitated his example and finish our work before we go to be with the Lord. On the cross, when Jesus cried, "It is finished," he was saying that he had done what his Father had given him the task of doing. Alongside the many manuscripts of the Bible that archaeologists find as they're excavating and searching and looking, there have been a lot of just insignificant documents that have been found. Some of them that were dredged up were as simple as receipts for business transactions that took place during the days of Jesus, during the time of the ancient world, the first century AD. And on top of many of those documents, those receipts that were given back would be the word tetelestai, indicating that the bill had been paid in full. Jesus gives us two very simple tenets of salvation in Romans chapter 3 and Romans chapter 6, where he says the wages of sin is death, and we've all sinned. There's a point in our life when we become aware of sin, and its power then comes alive within us, and we are enslaved to it. Everyone. Well, the price to be set for sin is death. And God says this principle forth in the book of Leviticus. "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood by the reason of the life that makes atonement." Atonement is made. Sin is covered when blood is spilt. Now, do we understand our predicament? You've sinned. I've sinned. The wages of the sin that we have committed against God is death. Now, for about 1,500 years, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of animals died to atone for the sins of God's people. But then we come to Jesus. He makes a statement in Mark 10 and verse 45 where he says, "Even the Son of Man did not come to serve, to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." We all know what a ransom is. It's money that is paid for the return of a captured person. It's the act of freeing captivity from captivity or punishment. So when sin awakened within us, we would call that the age of accountability. When sin awakened within us and we become aware that we have transgressed God's law, we become slaves and possessions of Satan. And blood is the price that must be paid for sin to be covered, and so that the sinner might come into the fellowship with God. The problem being, as is made known in the book of Hebrews, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. 10 to 15 to 20, who knows how many countless millions of animals died in attempts to cover the sins of the people, and still it wasn't enough for them to truly enter into God's presence. Look with me to Hebrews 10. See, when Jesus cried on the cross, "It is finished," he was declaring that atonement for sin was complete. What Jesus is saying, "It is finished, paid in full." 1 Timothy 2:6, Paul tells us that Jesus gave himself as a ransom for all. That is, Jesus paid the ransom fee on the cross when he shed his blood and when he died. This is for everyone. This is for everyone for all time. Sin is dealt with. The price has been paid once and for all. Now, that doesn't mean everyone receives it, but it does mean that it's there for those, and everyone now has access to it. Hebrews 10, look down in verse 11. "Every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices which can," there it is again, "same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But he having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting for that time onward until his enemies be made a footstool for his feet. For by the one offering he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified." So the Hebrew writer is showing us and demonstrating to us the sufficiency of Jesus' blood as a sacrifice and atonement for sin. Verse 10, "Sanctified through the offering of the body for Jesus once for all." Verse 12, "Jesus having offered one sacrifice for all time." Verse 14, "For by one offering he has perfected for all time those who are sanctified." Listen to me. It is finished. The price has been paid. And it's so important that you understand what I'm about to say. My debt for sin and your debt for sin has been paid in full with the blood of Jesus. You and I cannot add to what Christ has done regarding atonement. For thousands of years, man has tried to add to the saving work of Jesus, to the saving work of God. Back in the garden when sin awakened in Adam and Eve when they ate from the tree that God commanded them not to, immediately, first thing they do, they try to cover up their own sin. They realize that they were naked. They take and they sew for themselves some kind of covering made from fig leaves. That's inadequate. Their attempt to cover their sin was insufficient. God has to cover that sin. He kills animals and makes for them garments of skin, animal skin. He covers the sin, and those animals died, gave their life for the sin of Adam and Eve so that their sin could be covered. Last Wednesday morning, I visited Camden for a gospel meeting. Jacob Hudgens was there, and as you would expect, he did a great job. I was afterward invited to lunch with a dear friend, an older lady recently widowed. She promised to pay, so of course I'm going to go. In the middle of the meal, I went up to get a to-go box, and while I was there, I paid for the meal. And so we get ready to leave. She goes up and tries to pay on the way out, and I get busted for what I did. Oh, she graciously accepted, but how do you suppose I might feel if she said, "You know, he didn't pay enough. I'm going to leave some money here anyway. I don't care that he paid. I'm going to leave some money anyway." Well, I'd be upset. I'd be offended. I paid the bill. I paid what was owed, and now you're going to insult me by disregarding the kindness that I've shown? Listen, we're not talking about somebody else's meal ticket. We're talking about taking souls that were owned by Satan, in possession of the wicked one, destined for hell, and ransoming them and making those souls that were servants of Satan into sons and daughters of God. That's what's under consideration here as we think about atonement. When you and I look what Jesus Christ has done for us, we must understand it's finished. It's paid in full. The ransom price has been covered. When we try to add something to what Jesus has done, we're saying, "God, what you did wasn't enough. I've got to add my contribution to that." We taint, we spoil, we ruin the sacrifice of Jesus. Now, I know how the game goes. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. If you think going to church has anything to do with you being forgiven by God, let me say this, you're wrong. If you're reading, you think reading your Bible has anything to do with you being forgiven by God, you're wrong. If you think giving money has anything to do with you being forgiven by God, causing that forgiveness, you're wrong. Fill in the blank with whatever you like. Sacrifice, prayers, sharing the gospel, mission work. I don't care if you gave your life. If you do any of those things with the intent or expectation that they in some way are a factor in you being forgiven by God, you are dead wrong. That attitude slaps God in the face and says, "What you've done isn't enough. You need me to add to that." Now, it's important to understand that we are not saved by good works. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourself. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. God knows if we did something good, if he required something good of us to contribute to our salvation, we'd never let him hear the end of it. And so he says, "You can't earn it." Now, don't stop listening, because good works do come, and they are necessary. But it is essential for us to understand where in the equation they fall. Ephesians 2:8, "For by grace, through faith, you've been saved." Now, we understand that faith is not simply believing. It is the things that lead us to obey what God has asked us to do. But if you move good works to that left side of the equation, having anything to do with salvation, you mess up God's equation. When Jesus cried out, "It's finished," he meant it. The ransom price for sin has been paid. Yet good works do have a part, do have a component in that, but not on the earning or bringing about salvation. Rather, they come at the end of the equation after one has been saved. You add your good works to salvation after the fact. You can't contribute, but they are the result of the fact that you have been saved by God. I love God for what He's done, and so therefore I'm going to do what God has asked me to do. I'm going to read, I'm going to study, I'm going to pray, I'm going to encourage, I'm going to sacrifice, I'm going to serve. They don't affect salvation, but they follow salvation. For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works that God has before ordained, so that we might walk in them. The ransom price for sin has been paid. Knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life, inherited from your forefathers, but with the precious blood as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. When Jesus cried, "It is finished," atonement in that moment was completed. Finally, when Jesus cried, "It is finished," He was bringing an end to His war with the enemy. To Satan, Jesus' death on the cross was the atom bomb that dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was the action that brought about a decisive end to the war with the enemy. And as Jesus dies, His spirit enters paradise, where He is now forever beyond the reach of the devil. There's a couple of ways that we can interpret Jesus' life. I believe both are correct. Simply two different perspectives that meld together. From our perspective, in His death on the cross, Jesus was making atonement for the sins of the world. But from God's perspective, in Jesus' death on the cross, Jesus was bringing an end to this war. Now, if we think that what God has done is just about us, then we have the story backward. This is about God. This is about God's glory. This is about God's honor. This is about God's victory. This is about God's triumph. Now, we get to play a part, but we need to understand that we are but a part of a bigger story that is beyond what we can see and read with our eyes. See, for thousands of years, mankind has been living on a battlefield. We are participants in a cosmic war between light and dark, good and evil, God and Satan. Now, you might say the gauntlet was thrown down by the devil whenever he, through temptation and sin, led Adam and Eve away from God. There's no confusion. Just so there's no confusion, we need to understand that the battle that took place between God and Satan was not up for grabs. It was not to see who was stronger. God has always been the undisputed, decisive winner from the moment that it began. There's nothing Satan can do to stop it. In fact, listen to the declaration that God makes as He proclaims victory in Genesis 3:15 after man sins, speaking to the serpent, speaking to Satan, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel." So God announces His plan, and He claims victory right here at the beginning. If you will, Satan drew first blood. However, the killing blow belongs to God. And for several thousand years, and even now, this battle rages on between good and evil, and we just get caught up in it. When the time was right, God sent His Son. God sends His ace into the world. The fighting gets hot and heavy. You ever noticed how many attempts were made by the devil in Jesus' life? Now, I say Satan made those attempts on Jesus' life. Yes, I know mankind was involved. As I said, we get to be players in the story that belongs to God. But when Jesus came into the world and took on flesh, Satan really amps up his attempts. He knows if he can get rid of Jesus, then he can finish this and he can defeat God. You know, so many times Satan makes attempts on the life of Jesus. Before he is much more than a newborn babe, Satan uses Herod to try to kill Jesus. You see, if he can kill Jesus before the time is right, no salvation, no redemption, no ransom price being paid. All souls belong to him. Satan wins. And so he uses Herod through his influence to try to kill Jesus as an infant. God protects him. Time and again, he tries to kill Jesus for the cross. And we know Jesus has an encounter with Satan after he is anointed by the Spirit, after he's baptized, after the Father speaks and commissions him to this task. He goes to the mountain. Satan is lured out to the open. He tries to get Jesus to sin. Can't do that, so he resorts to trying to kill him. time and again through Scripture. In Luke 4, the citizens in Jesus' hometown get angry, and so they try to drive Jesus off a cliff. And Jesus uses their pride and their anger to try to kill him. The Jews want to seize Jesus at a feast in John 7 so that they may take him and kill him, but they can't because of the crowds. Time and time and time again, people are seeking Jesus' life. Satan is trying to cause them to bring about Jesus' end before the time is right. When the right moment finally comes along, Jesus allows himself to fall into Satan's hands. In John 12, Jesus answered, saying, "The hour has come." Satan tried to hasten it along, but the hour has come, Jesus says, "for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." And so the time is now. Jesus goes to the garden. The traitor is here. By his own admission, Jesus is giving himself up, where he says, "While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours." So Jesus goes to the cross. Satan doesn't know what's happening. As Jesus dies, the Son of God dies, he thinks the victory belongs to him. He thinks that by killing God's Son, he's won. But he's wrong. He is wrong. This is God's plan. This is God's hour. This is God's victory. It is finished. And there's no going back. Paul says, if Satan and the angels would have known the wisdom of God, they would never have crucified the Lord of glory. You see, if Jesus didn't die on the cross, there'd be no atonement. There'd be no sacrifice for sin. If he'd have just left Jesus alone, he might have won. But the devil couldn't resist. He took the bait. He thought he put Jesus on the cross. But he failed to realize Jesus was on the cross because he chose to be. We see this plan coming to fruition, this spiritual war coming to fruition on the cross. We see that Jesus canceled out the debt of certificate consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us. And he's taking it out of the way. How did he do it? By nailing it to the cross. What did he do? He disarmed the rulers and its authorities. I'm going to suggest to you those are spiritual rulers and authority. He disarmed the rulers and authority. He made a public display of them, triumphing over them through him, through his death on the cross. And he makes it very more clear in Hebrews 2:14. Since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself, Jesus, likewise partook of the same through death, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is, the devil. The battle still rages on, but the war is ended. It's finished. When Jesus went to the cross, he cried out, "It's finished." His suffering came to an end. His task came to an end. The atonement for sin was fulfilled in that moment. And this war between God and Satan was finished. What must one do with a finished work? Two things. We must claim it. There's a popular saying in the religious world, believe in the finished work of Christ. I almost agree with that. We just need to change one little word. Instead of believe, obey the finished work of Christ. Now, to claim atonement, the forgiveness which Jesus purchased for us, I must obey what God has commanded. Now, understand, we are not adding to the work of Jesus whenever we obey the things that God has called us to do. Otherwise, believing would be. These are conditional acts that God has placed on forgiveness. But we must believe that Jesus is God's Son. We must turn from our sin and say to the flesh, "You're not what I want. You're not my master anymore. I'm going to put these things away and I'm going to follow Jesus." And we must confess Him as Lord and King of our life. And we must die with Him in baptism, so that we can rise a new man, a forgiven man, ready to enter into the good works that God has purchased for me. So by obeying the finished work of Jesus, that's how we claim what He has purchased for us. And after I claim it, I must proclaim it. Like many of you, last Wednesday was a very somber day for me. It was the anniversary, 18 years of September the 11th, 2001, when over 3,000 Americans lost their life in a series of terroristic attacks. Suppose 18 years ago on that September the 10th, you were given some sort of knowledge of what was going to happen the next day. that the planes were going to be hijacked and Islamic extremists were going to fly those planes into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, and that over 3,000 Americans would be dead at the end of the day due to a group of a hatred from a group of Muslims. What would you do? Would you go back to sleep that night and peacefully rest, knowing that thousands of families were soon going to spend the next night without fathers, mothers, and children? Would you turn on the news that morning so that you could be on the scene when all of it started happening and you could catch it from the beginning? Not one of us. Not one of us armed with that sort of foreknowledge would have went to bed that night without trying to have done something to stop it. We'd have called airlines, we'd have called police, we'd have called 911, we'd have tried to get the government to know this is what's going to happen, you need to do something to avoid this tragedy. Yet how many of us go to bed at night, rise up in the morning, talk with friends, family, co-workers, loved ones whom we know are not right with God, who we know are tragedies waiting to happen, who we know that if their life is claimed, their number's called, or the Lord returns, that they will be separated from God for all of eternity? How many times do we close our eyes and pretend everything's just fine? This is good news. The gospel is good news. The power of sin has been broken. Satan has been defeated. Death has been defeated. We should be proclaiming God's victory. You're a chosen race, royal priesthood, a nation, a people for God's own possession, so that, why? So that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. We've claimed the finished work of Jesus by obeying it. We don't try to add to it, but we conditionally obey what we must to receive it. And when we proclaim it by sharing the good news with others who are in darkness, so that they can join us and know the freedom that's only found in the life and light of Jesus. Let me end where I began. I wrote this Friday, and not having seen Arkansas play on Saturday, I said this might be the last time you get to see Arkansas win. But now, after having watched us yesterday, we may have another game or two within us. Right before Hunter Henry is taken to the ground, he makes a desperation heave, throwing the ball into the backfield where the Arkansas players are standing. An Ole Miss defender bats it, but Alex Collins catches it and runs 30 yards for the first down. They punch it in the end zone, go for the two-point conversion, and win the game. Now, if you pause your TV at the right moment, you might would have thought this game is over. If you look at the cross at the right moment and you pause it there, you might have thought Jesus' last cry was a cry of defeat. But it wasn't. It was a cry of victory. It was a cry of triumph. Have you claimed the victory that Jesus has purchased for you? And if you have claimed it by obedience, are you proclaiming it so that others might share in the marvelous light of the gospel, the saving work of Jesus? If we can help you in obedience to the gospel, if we can help you in serving the Lord in any way, would you make your need known as we stand and as we sing the song of invitation?